This message comes from Wall Street Journal sponsor C3 AI. C3 Generative AI equips enterprises with verified, traceable answers. It's secure, hallucination-free, LLM agnostic, and IP liability-free. Learn more at c3.ai. This is Enterprise AI.
The U.S. prepares to punish Russia with sanctions, among other actions. We'll have more on today's expected announcement. Plus, a strong start to earnings season.
Yesterday, we saw some strength in the banking sector. This will be closely watched to see if it continues on more of a sector-wide basis.
We'll look at what else is catching the attention of Wall Street. And it's a red-hot housing market, and international investors want to be part of it. It's Thursday, April 15th. I'm Mark Stewart with The Wall Street Journal, and this is what's news. The U.S. is expected to announce a wide range of measures against Russia today, including sanctions for its alleged role in election interference and hacking. This is according to people familiar with the matter. We're also told the U.S. could expel 10 Russian officials, including some over allegations that Russia offered to pay bounties to militants in Afghanistan to kill U.S. service members. President Biden spoke with Russian President Vladimir Putin on Tuesday about the complaints. The White House said the president extended a personal invitation to meet with Putin in the coming months. Russia has yet to accept the invite and is likely to respond to the U.S. actions with some of their own. Russian officials have repeatedly denied interfering in U.S. elections and denied involvement in the SolarWinds hack. The use of Johnson & Johnson's single-dose COVID-19 vaccine in the U.S. is still on pause following an advisory panel meeting to discuss future use. The WSJ's Peter Loftus covers the pharmaceutical industry and healthcare.
The CDC's vaccine committee decided to put off a vote, effectively leaving this pause in place, because they felt like they didn't have enough information about this rare but serious type of blood clot that has occurred in a handful of people who received the J&J vaccine. They feel like they need more information about the risks and benefits of the vaccine to be able to say whether vaccinations could continue, but perhaps with restrictions by gender or by age group. And they also feel like it's possible that more reports of this type of blood clot will come in since the pause just went into effect Tuesday, so they're hoping to meet in another week or two to take a vote.
We are reporting exclusively that American Airlines and JetBlue are facing increased scrutiny from the Justice Department. It stems from an agreement to market each other's flights on certain routes to boost offerings in the Northeast. Officials are concerned the alliance could diminish competition at key airports. The airlines say the pact is good for travelers, giving them more options. An American Airlines spokeswoman said the company is fully cooperating with the DOJ review. A Justice Department spokeswoman declined to comment. And in a suburb of Minneapolis, protesters gathered for a fourth night over the death of 20-year-old Dante Wright during a traffic stop. The former officer who shot Wright is scheduled to make her first court appearance today. As we told you on the show last night, Kim Potter was arrested yesterday and charged with second-degree manslaughter. She posted bond and was released from the Hennepin County Jail Wednesday evening. Her lawyer didn't respond to requests for comment. We're going to be getting a lot of data today that will help us understand the current health of our economy. Weekly jobless claims will be released, and we'll get a look at retail sales in the U.S. And on the topic of shopping, we're seeing a rebound in first quarter sales from LVMH, which owns many luxury brands, including Louis Vuitton and Tiffany. The numbers defy the pandemic's drag on the global economy. For more on this and the earnings day ahead, let's bring in markets reporter Anna Hertenstein in London. Hi there, Anna. Good morning.
Morning, Mark.
So what's the big takeaway here when some of the most expensive brands see some growth?
So LVMH, which is this large European luxury conglomerate with 75 brands, reported a really strong first quarter. They said that sales rose 30% compared to the previous year. And this is interesting because there's a lot of concern around what the pandemic could do to the luxury industry, especially with the restrictions on travel, what this does to tourism. But LVMH said it was able to weather this really well. because it recently expanded its operations in e-commerce and opened new stores in China and the US. And that's where we've seen rapid vaccine rollouts that have led to eased lockdowns, and also where shoppers often travel from. So they went straight to the source and were able to see an 86% jump in sales in Asia, which excludes Japan.
Anna, let's look ahead to today's earnings calendar. We're going to hear from some sectors that are very telling about the economic recovery.
This is a big week in terms of financial heavyweights earnings. We already had Goldman and JP Morgan report earlier in the week. Today we have Bank of America, Citigroup, and also BlackRock. Yesterday we saw some strength in the banking sector. So this will be closely watched to see if it continues on more of a sector-wide basis. We also have some household names like Pepsi and Delta Airlines reporting today. Delta will be closely watched for any changes to that out their outlook and what this could mean for travel, which has been decimated by the pandemic.
Anna Hertenstein, thank you. Just ahead, America's housing boom is getting the attention of investors from around the world. More after the break.
This message comes from Wall Street Journal sponsor C3 AI. Insights. You need them to solve business problems, but buried in volumes of disparate data, they're seemingly invisible. C3 Generative AI enables business leaders to instantly access secure, hallucination-free, verifiable insights from a unified knowledge source, all with a natural language search. Turn the invisible into the obvious with C3 Generative AI. Learn more at c3.ai.
We're in the midst of the hottest housing market in more than a decade. Limited inventory, low interest rates, and bidding wars are driving prices through the roof. But it's not just homeowners competing against each other. Investors from the U.S. and overseas are also snapping up single-family homes to rent or flip. So how is that impacting the real estate market, and what could it mean for home buyers? Let's bring in our commercial real estate reporter, Conrad Poutsier. Conrad, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Conrad, we saw a lot of investors get into the single-family home market when the housing bubble burst in 2011. Back then, they were buying foreclosures on the cheap. We're obviously in a different situation now. So what's the draw now when prices are skyrocketing?
So the reason all these investors are buying rental homes today is very different from a decade ago. A decade ago, it was in no small part due to supply. There were just so many cheap homes, foreclosed homes, so many newly built homes that were basically available for investors to buy very cheaply. This time around, this is not the case. Homes are very expensive. Prices are rising. There aren't that many newly built homes. What's driving all this investor interest this time around is demand. So basically, investors are saying, there are all these millennials who are now reaching the age where they want to move to the suburbs and have kids. There are all these high-earning young professionals who are working from home for the past year, want some more space, and are deciding they want to move to the suburbs. And they basically look at this demand and see a huge opportunity to make a ton of money.
Where are we seeing this play out, and what kind of investors are getting into this market?
So we're seeing this play out in all those cities where home prices and rents are rising and where there are a lot of single-family homes. So think Las Vegas, Phoenix, Atlanta, the usual suspects for suburban homes. And the types of investors that we're seeing go into this space is really expanding. So for the past few years, you've already had a lot of private equity companies, real estate investment firms, Wall Street firms get into this space and buy up hundreds or thousands of single-family homes. What you're seeing now is you're also starting to see foreign investors get into this space. So these might be sovereign wealth funds, insurance companies like Allianz from Germany, pension funds, who are now also really getting interested in this space.
Well, let's talk more about the foreign investors. In the past, they've mostly focused on commercial real estate, shopping centers, office buildings, even apartment complexes. Single-family homes are pretty new territory for them. What's driving the shift?
Yeah, so I think to answer that question, you really have to understand why foreign investors invest in real estate in the U.S. So one thing they're looking for is they want to have a safe, stable investment where their money is just not going to disappear tomorrow. And whenever there's a new asset class, like single-family rentals, which basically didn't exist 10 years ago, investors are often initially apprehensive. And they think, well, this hasn't really proven itself in a downturn. Maybe in the next crisis, the market is going to crash entirely. Now, we just had a huge recession and rents didn't go down by much in a lot of these suburbs. So investors are saying, okay, it's proven itself. The second thing that's happening is a lot of these investors basically, especially sovereign wealth funds and big pension funds, big insurance companies, they want to invest a lot of money with very little effort. They have small teams on the ground in the United States. And so in the past, what they've often done is they'd buy huge office buildings in Manhattan, for example, because you can basically spend $500 million on a single building and you don't have to hire many people to manage it. It's just very simple. It's an easy way to spend a lot of money. With single family rentals, you couldn't do that in the past. You know, the usual way to do this was you'd go to courthouses, you'd hire brokers and buy them one by one, which, you know, if you're a huge fund with few people in the US, it's just too tedious for you to do this. And what's happening now is that you're having more US investment companies doing all this work, buying all these buildings in bulk, and then going to these foreign institutions and saying, hey, why don't you give me a couple hundred million dollars or $1 billion? I'll do all the work for you, and you can essentially spend a ton of money without doing much work. And that's very appealing to these funds.
This is obviously impacting home supply, which is one of the biggest factors for home prices. Right now, supply is at the lowest it's been in years. With all of these investors turning single-family homes into rentals, what could the long-term impact be, not just for the real estate market, but also for the communities?
Yeah. So for the US as a whole, for now, the impact of institutional investment and certainly foreign investment in these single-family rentals is very small. So there's still a very small part of the market. And when you think of like the top 10 reasons why home prices are increasing in the US, foreign pension funds and sovereign wealth funds aren't among them yet. But of course, as more money comes into this space and more foreign institutions become interested in this, this could change and they could actually impact the market. And I think it'll be really interesting to see what exactly this does to the market. So there are two really countervailing forces happening here. On the one hand, you have more people, more big funds with a lot of money come into the space, increasing demand, making it harder for home buyers, for families to compete for these homes, raising prices. So that's clearly happening. That's clearly going to happen. And that's clearly bad news if you're a household that wants to buy a home. But on the other hand, what some of these investors are arguing is that they might actually ultimately increase supply of new homes. Because the way this is works is, say you're a big home builder, right? And you want to build 1,000 rental homes in a city. There's always risk involved in that, right? But if you can strike a deal with like a foreign pension fund or a sovereign wealth fund, and the fund says, just build those homes and I'm going to buy them from you and I'm going to sign that contract right now, there's no risk involved for you anymore. And so the argument that the proponents of this make is basically that by removing so much risk from the equation, they ultimately make it more likely that more homes are going to get built. That increases supply and ultimately makes housing more affordable. So you have these two forces. On the one hand, more demand driving up prices. On the other hand, maybe if things go right, more construction. And it'll be really interesting to see which one will win out.
Conrad Putzier, thank you for sharing your reporting with us.
Thanks for having me on.
And finally, school band practices may never be the same in our pandemic world. Tightly packed practice rooms with students blowing on instruments can spread particles carrying COVID-19. Throw in some singers, and you could have a problem. With the virus still spreading and new variants emerging, researchers have been looking for ways to make band practices safer, including a mask of sorts for your instrument. The journal Sarah Choi has more.
Researchers at the University of Colorado Boulder and the University of Maryland have found a few simple ways they say can help mitigate that risk. So one of them is putting covers on the bells of wind instruments. It's very simple. You can basically put a surgical mask and attach it with a rubber band around the bell of the instrument. They also recommend masks with a little slit in them, just so you can play the instrument, and that helps kind of block aerosols and droplets as well. They recommend that you stand at least 6 feet apart. And for larger instruments like the trombone, they recommend more than that, so 9 feet.
You can read more about what the future of band practice could be like on WSJ.com. And that's what's news for Thursday. We're back tonight with a new show. If you like us, please rate and review us from wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Mark Stewart with The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.
This message comes from Wall Street Journal sponsor C3 AI. C3 Generative AI equips enterprises with verified, traceable answers. It's secure, hallucination-free, LLM agnostic, and IP liability-free. Learn more at c3.ai. This is Enterprise AI.